Please identify yourself and your client before you begin speaking and let us know how we can reference you. These matters are being recorded. There are no other recordings permitted. And with that, counsel, whenever you are ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and opposing counsel. My name is Grant Gibo. I'm appearing today on behalf of the appellant, Andrew Schell, in this case. Your Honor, the trial court below erred in determining that the automobile exception applied to the warrantless search of a lockbox, which was removed from a vehicle, of an impounded vehicle, several days after the impounding of the vehicle. Minnesota law is clear that probable cause to search a container extends to containers located within an automobile if the containers themselves are located in the automobile when probable cause to search the greater automobile exists. In this case, it presents a slightly different situation because probable cause, based on the record below, did not arise until after this container was removed from the vehicle.
You don't think that her behavior when she got to the impound lot, as described by the district court, found by the district court, gave fresh PC to law enforcement?
I don't, Your Honor. And the reason why is if you look at the actions of law enforcement did not believe that she was acting suspicious until after the lockbox was removed from the car. And on this issue, I would...
Go ahead.
No, but to this question, Your Honor, I would direct the court to pages 30 and 31 of the October 27th, whatever the transcript for the omnibus hearing below.
Let's assume that's true. I have a series of questions. I want to just understand what his privacy interest is in that lockbox,
sure,
which was removed from the car. Are you saying that once she removes the lockbox from the car, that the lockbox is no longer part of the car? It's not a container within the car?
Correct.
It's something separate?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it's in her possession?
Yep.
Not his possession, right?
Actual possession, correct.
Is it his?
The lockbox?
Yeah.
I mean, the trial court found it did. They used the evidence of, you know, the narcotics in the lockbox to support his arrest. So, well, I would argue, you know, legally, yes.
Well, they found constructive possession. But was the lockbox his property?
I don't think we know that, Your Honor, but because, you know, they're both co-defendants in this case, their cases, you know, sort of rise and fall together in this situation. So, you know,
What's his privacy interest in the box?
If it's coming from his vehicle?
Well, I mean, three answers ago, you said that the box was hers because she took it out of the car, right? So, and it's separate from the car, which is his. I mean, generally, the Fourth Amendment is concerned with privacy interests. And what I'm trying to ascertain is, what is his privacy interest in that box when it's removed from the car?
Sure, Your Honor.
If it's part of the car, we've got a different problem, or I think you've got a different problem, because then the automobile exception is in play. But if it's out of the car and in her possession, hidden in her coat, what's his privacy interest in that lockbox?
You know, I guess I would say, you know, we don't know in the record below, and perhaps I missed this in the record, who actually claimed to have owned the lockbox. I'm pretty sure both defendants just said, you know, it's not ours. But it came from the vehicle that they both were in possession of, and that's the issue. He's obviously asserting a privacy right in the lockbox below because he challenged the constitutionality of the search of the lockbox.
That's my question, whether he had any standing to challenge the constitutionality of the lockbox.
I believe so, Your Honor. And
why is that?
Because it came from
his... it's in her possession.
Well, and Your Honor, maybe perhaps I misspoke, or let me clarify what I said earlier. You know, the lockbox came from the vehicle, which I don't think anyone is disputing. And then once it came from the vehicle, the automobile exception still does not apply because it came from the vehicle before probable cause to search the vehicle arose.
Let's assume that probable cause continued from the time of the initial seizure of the vehicle.
Okay.
Which I think you might have a problem with U.S. versus Johns, which is not cited in any of the briefing, but it does stand for that proposition, that continues. It's a U.S. Supreme Court case.
Well, Your Honor, but probable cause is not, you know, a continuous factor, it dissipates at some point. And Your Honor, to your point, if the automobile exception applied, I agree with you. That's the definitive issue in this case. If the automobile exception applied, they did not need a warrant to search the box. We lose.
How is this any different than our purse cases, where a somebody exits a vehicle and brings their purse with them out of the vehicle, and police search the purse when it's out of the vehicle in the possession of its holder?
Because it depends. Okay, so it depends on when probable cause to search the vehicle applied, assuming that the automobile exception applied. And in that issue, I direct the court to the Campagna-Vaughn case, which it's an unpublished decision by this court, 2002.
I'm familiar with it, yeah.
But that case is on point in our opinion, Your Honor, because it deals with this very question. There, the defendant removed a backpack from a vehicle, then probable cause to search the vehicle crystallized. But this court held that you don't have a right to go into the bag that was removed before probable cause arose in conjunction with the vehicle itself. That's exactly what this situation is.
So in your view, does the case turn, I mean, I guess I read your briefing a little bit differently. My understanding of your briefing was that the search of the lockbox was illegal because she took it out of the car. And today I'm hearing you say that the search of the lockbox was illegal because there was no probable cause to search the car at the time she went and collected the lockbox from the car.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, I mean, which
one
is correct?
The latter, Your Honor. And I believe that's laid out in our brief, but I'm that's why we're here. I can help clarify that. The reason that the search of the lockbox was illegal is because it was not located within the vehicle at a time on May 19th when police officers had, March 19th, on the impound day, had probable cause to search the vehicle itself.
So you're saying that probable cause dissipated sometime during that 6-day period?
Yes, Your Honor. And a good illustration of this, you can look at the actions that the police officers took on the day when Ms. Edwards went to the vehicle, right? Because probable cause is an objective standard based on what the officers see at the time. And we have testimony in the record, again, at page 30 to 31 of the transcript, where the officers said they weren't paying attention to what she was doing. They saw her going back and forth between the front and the back of the car. And one of the officers even helped her, go under the hood of the car to look for wires to remove a police scanner.
Well, that's what she claimed to be needing to do.
But again, Your Honor, look at what the officers are doing. At one point, the officer testified he did not pay attention to what they were doing because he was on the phone with a different law enforcement officer. So,
is that the second officer? Second officer seemed to be much more focused on her conduct.
I believe it was the first officer to arrive at the scene. I believe it's Giese. I don't know the names offhand, Your Honor.
I had the same confusion that Judge Frisch did about the theory here because it seemed to me you were arguing dissipation of the probable cause and the exception to the warrant requirement with that 6-day delay, despite the fact that the car remained in the custody of the police in the impound lot. But then, it seemed to me you were saying that there was, as soon as she got that box out, that destroyed, in essence, the protection.
No, Your Honor. It's that there was no probable cause when she went to the impound lot, and that's evident by the officer's actions in allowing her to have, fairly unrestricted access right away when they weren't paying attention
to the car.
Well,
under supervision. I mean, it wasn't like they just said, go ahead.
But the triggering event which caused officers to approach her and, sort of escalate the situation and take possession of the lockbox occurred, after the box was removed. She had it wrapped up in her jacket, and then her companion, I don't know how to describe the man that was with her, but was blocking their view. That is what gave them suspicion to address the situation.
Well, also the way she put the jacket on the hood of the car was that deputy's testimony, as I recall. Some things that preceded her actually taking the box out.
But the triggering event, in our view, Your Honor, that caused officers to, spring into action was her clutching the jacket when the lockbox was already removed. And at that point, that's when a new probable cause would trigger. And because it was outside of the car when that happened, we're urging the court to follow the Campagna-Vaughn logic, which, again, it's unpublished, but it's the only, Minnesota case that we have currently cited in either party's briefs on this issue, to show that the automobile exception didn't apply. At that point, officers should have seized the box, sought a warrant. Could they have obtained a warrant? Probably, but that's not the issue that is before the court today. The issue is whether or not that warrantless search was constitutional.
But that argument to be successful relies on the dissipation, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And it's you know, it's a good question because it's not just the length of time. It's not just the 6-day delay. It's the 6-day delay coupled with the officer's, you know, somewhat relaxed actions with her when they're at the impound lot themselves, right? If we just had the 6-day delay and officers were closely observing her while she was removing stuff and we didn't have this testimony to the effect of, oh, you know, I wasn't paying attention and, you know, I saw her go back and forth a couple times, it'd be a different case. But that's a fact issue which is important here and relevant to the probable cause analysis because it's a fact-intensive analysis. But going back to Your Honor's question, I mean, yes, like that's the key issue in this case is whether or not the automobile exception applied to the lockbox after it was removed from the car. And in our view, there was no probable cause to search the automobile itself until after the lockbox had been removed.
At what point did probable cause dissipate?
You know, I don't think we have a hard point. I would say, you know, since it's a somewhat fluid standard for a reason, right? Because it gives officers some level of discretion to determine whether it's there. And if I had to pinpoint a time, it would be, you know, when they allowed her to access the vehicle and under the hood of the vehicle without direct observation of what she was doing.
What if they had not conducted their inventory search of the car at that time? I mean, we don't have that in the record, but, you know, it's impounded. Police officers are busy. Maybe they didn't do their inventory search. Would they have to get a warrant to do the inventory search?
No, not at that point, Your Honor. But, you know, that's not the facts before us. The facts before us are the officers let I guess I don't know if she was a defendant or was charged at that point, but they let someone access the car without direct observation. That shows to me that they don't suspect.
Well, I mean, there was an officer with her at all times.
Well, I think with her is not entirely physically.
I mean, there was someone under the hood with her.
At certain points, but not for the entire time that she was under the hood, right? But the officer had observed her. He came and helped. He went back. He was, you know, surveying the situation from a distance, but he wasn't directly observing what she was doing or if she was removing anything. And all this is relevant, Your Honor, because if the officers had an inkling when she arrived at the impound lot on the 19th that there was evidence of criminal activity in the vehicle, why did they let her access it without direct observation at the time?
Well, I mean, I can speculate as to why they would have done that. My question, what about the doctrine of inevitable discovery? So the car is in the impound lot. We don't know if an inventory search has been conducted. It wasn't going anywhere anytime soon. Why wouldn't the doctrine of inevitable discovery sort of save this if it is an illegal search, illegal search?
If that was the case, Your Honor, I would request that the court remand this and conduct an investigation, because I assume that there's a record considering whether there's been an inventory search. So if that's the linchpin for this argument, you know, our requested relief would be a remand and adjudication on that factual issue. I would say, Your Honor, that they did conduct a search of the car when it was initially seized on the 13th, and we know that because that's where they initially found narcotics to
arrest. They were in the back seat, right?
I
think it was in the back seat.
Sure. But that's, you know, all of this is relevant, Your Honor. So, again, just you know, to put a point on it, if the automobile exception applies, my client, you know, we don't have an argument to exclude the evidence found in the lockbox. But that's the issue in this case is whether or not the automobile exception applies. Now, very briefly, Your Honor, I know that the state raised two other justifications or warrant requirement exceptions in their brief. The first is the Terry exception. We briefed this out in our reply brief, just want to hit on it really quick. You know, Terry doesn't apply here because as soon as officers seized the lockbox, they testified they knew it wasn't a weapon. As soon as that happens, State v. Dickerson, you need to get a warrant to search the inside of it. Same argument with regards to asserted exigency with respect to the search of the lockbox. Once the lockbox was seized, there was no exigency which justified a warrantless search. The proper constitutional actions that should have been taken in this case are the box should have been seized and a warrant should have been obtained, but that did not happen, and because of that, evidence inside the lockbox should have been excluded, and in that regard, the trial court erred. I'm almost out of time. If Your Honors have no other questions, I will take a seat.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel.
Thanks.
You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel?
Your Honors, Counsel, my name is Lisa Lodine, and I am an Assistant Attorney General representing the state as the respondent in this matter. I'd like to address first expectation of privacy, as you raised, Judge Frisch, and then go on to the probable cause. And our ultimate point here is when you look at the police officer's actions, were they an unreasonable search of the box? That applies to the constitutional rights of Mr. Schell. So first, when you talk about a warrantless search of the box, in Jacobson, cited by opposing counsel, he notes that a container which can support a reasonable expectation of privacy cannot be searched. The state claims Mr. Schell does not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in this box. The box was, So there's a range of expectations of privacies. In your home, you have the ultimate expectation of privacy. In an automobile, obviously, based on overwhelming case law precedent, the automobile, you have a lesser amount of privacy. And so,
but you still have an expectation of privacy in the automobile, and you need probable cause to search the automobile.
Right.
So the argument is that probable cause dissipated by the time the lockbox was discovered.
Right. And I can
and fresh PC was needed. So I'd like you to address whether probable cause dissipated, and then whether there was fresh, assuming that it did dissipate, whether there was fresh PC.
Right. So actually, the test here on probable cause requires looking at the totality of the circumstances. So whether it dissipated or not is sort of irrelevant, that word, because what you have to look to is the information that the police officers had at the time they took these steps. And so you can add what happened on March 13th to what was happening on March 19th. And it's that accumulation, that totality of circumstances that were known by the officers, which did indeed establish probable cause to search. I'd like to go over these facts.
Just to clarify, Ms. Sure. Lodine, so you're saying dissipation doesn't matter. There was independent probable cause on the 19th.
Which took into account the facts from March 13th. Basically, your point that suspicions arose anew that cumulatively established probable cause before the lockbox was taken out of the car. So these facts were available. In fact, Ms. Edwards was a co-owner of the car. And if you look at the memorandum filed by the defense, document 32, they repeatedly claim that she is a co-owner of the car. It was her purse that had a holster, firearm, and magazine in it on that March 13th. She had a baggie with a heroin on her person, and she was arrested for firearms and drug offenses, which Sergeant Troutman looked on his computer as soon as he got there and found that information. As to Deputy Gizzi, he received an email that day from a party, is what the testimony says, to come get their personal property. That's what the evidence is. Nothing was said that this person was coming to obtain the defendant's, Mr. Schell's, property. The police had no indication that this stuff belonged to Mr. Schell. Then Ms. Edwards brings another person with her to obtain the personal property. She is there getting the property from an engine compartment. And then Edwards and Ward are acting suspiciously. They're obstructing the view of the officers. They're hanging around. She's got her coat off in the winter and pushes her coat down into the engine compartment. Now, the opposing counsel cites to the record about how suspicion, they didn't think her activity was suspicious until after she removed the box. Absolutely not supported by the record. So if you go to pages 11 and 12 of the transcript, Sergeant Troutman is being questioned. And he says, while we were there, I looked up the information about the previous traffic stop. And then his next testimony on page 12. Like I said, her behavior was odd in the fact that she was moving back and forth between the passenger compartment and the engine compartment, and it looked like there was a lot of busy work, but there was nothing being done. This is the officer's thought. Normally, when people recover property, they grab stuff deliberately out of the passenger compartment and load it into the vehicle that they arrived in. I noticed the cold temperature. She had removed her jacket. This behavior was odd to me and very suspicious. His claim to look at page 30 or so of the transcript is not the evidence that he claims it is.
So when he says it's suspicious, is it enough, or is what's missing from this record that it was suspicious of criminal activity?
So, it needs to be suspicious of criminal activity. However, what I didn't get to quite there, because that wasn't the facts that I was addressing, she goes on to shove her jacket into the engine compartment. That is completely abnormal, as they also testify to. So you have to add that fact. So she is a defendant in a criminal case involving seizure of firearms and drugs. And Sergeant Troutman knows that. She is doing this completely odd behavior to obtain personal property, including shoving a winter jacket down inside the engine compartment. This goes beyond suspicious. This is a car that had probable cause and items had been seized from. So whatever the state's position is, clearly that by the time she's sticking that down in there and pulling something out, they have renewed probable cause to search containers in the car. She brings one out, which makes it the same as the purses and other bags, duffel bags, backpacks. And so that point, it is not the crux of this case is not later. The crux of this case is when she is pulling that object out of the car. So let's look back to expectation of privacy and what the officers knew at that point that she has this item apparently wrapped in a jacket under her arm. She's the co-owner of the car. She's there to obtain personal property. She removes the box and has exclusive actual possession.
Does she? I mean, the box is, I mean, the car is seized. The car is seized for forfeiture in the impound lot. So the car and everything in it is in the possession, custody, and control of the officers, and she's still on the property. So does she even have the box at that point in time? Just because she's holding it, is it hers or is it still in police custody?
I do not. The state doesn't take the position that it's in police custody at that point in time.
Even though she's at the impound lot and is not free to go?
Well, she was free to go.
With the stuff, with the property.
There is no indication in the record that she was not free to go until the point she's already got the box in her possession and they decide to act to remove the box from her.
I think my question is inartful, and so let me rephrase it. It's not the first time, and it will not be the last. The police, when they seize property, don't let anybody just come and take it without inventorying what is being taken from the impound lot or from a vehicle. They would have to inventory it, I would presume. Is there something, I mean, I didn't see anything in the record about that, but I'm, and this sort of leads me to the question that I asked your esteemed colleague, and that is, why are we not talking about inevitable discovery?
The state is not talking about inevitable discovery because it was not raised below, and I understand we are now raising additional exceptions. The state is not taking the position that inevitable discovery does not apply, but in terms of raising new arguments, it was my choice as counsel not to raise inevitable discovery. So it hasn't been raised. However, the court has the discretion to decide the case to affirm the case on grounds other than what the district court did, if those apply, especially under Grunig, if you're not getting any additional or different relief, and if the record does not need to be expanded.
And what is his reasonable expectation of privacy in the vehicle once it has been impounded and designated for forfeiture?
Our claim is that he has no expectation of privacy at that point in time. He knows, there's no doubt, that the car was seized and it's in the possession of police and that it's been seized for forfeiture, meaning he's not getting it back. And so the state takes the position that he could not have had an expectation of privacy. And then you go to the fact that to the extent that Ms. Edwards was claiming some sort of expectation of privacy, she didn't either because of all those facts that developed.
Counsel?
Mm-hmm. So you started out with a statement essentially that you weren't going to address whether probable cause had dissipated in the time period between the 13th and the 19th. But I would appreciate if you could talk about the state's position about whether it did or did not dissipate and why, leaving aside whether or not there was fresh probable cause on the 19th.
Sure. The state's main argument is it doesn't matter because of the totality of the circumstances. However, the state also agrees or takes the position that probable cause did not dissipate. There was nothing significant that occurred between the time that the car was impounded and the time that Ms. Edwards came to look at it. So probable cause had existed to search all containers within the car starting on March 13th. Just because the police officers missed something magnetically attached under the engine compartment doesn't mean they don't still have that probable cause under all the facts at the time of the arrest to obtain and search any objects or containers that were inside the car. So we do take the position that it did not dissipate. However,
is there any case law here in Minnesota that addresses that?
Not that I am aware of, Your Honor.
Is that something that you think would be worth publishing on?
Yes. Sorry, that was a delayed response. The dissipation has obviously not been addressed, and if this court finds that they want to utilize that as a basis for the decision, absolutely the court can feel free to publish it. But again, our argument was you kind of don't need to go there because you add all the other information with the totality of the circumstances. And my recollection is the court doesn't like to decide anything it doesn't have to. And I see my time is just about up, so I appreciate the chance to argue. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
So first, Your Honor, just very briefly with respect to the, you know, privacy interest in the lockbox contained in the car. You know, the case law is clear that, you know, the type of container doesn't really matter for the purposes of the privacy expectation. We don't kind of go parsing out that a purse has a greater privacy expectation than a backpack or a briefcase or, in this case, a lockbox. So, you know, just because it was located within an automobile doesn't diminish the fact that it's still subject to the Fourth Amendment and needs to be either searched pursuant to a warrant or searched pursuant to an exception to the warrant requirement, which we don't think applies here.
Let me ask you about just sort of at a high level, what is the difference between his privacy interest? Let me rephrase it. How did the delay in the search of the lockbox from the time that the car was initially seized affect his privacy interest in the lockbox? Or how was his privacy interest changed during that time?
I don't believe that his privacy interest was changed at all during that time. What changed is the existence of probable cause to search the vehicle.
Well, that's my question, right? So if his privacy interest in the contents of the vehicle has not changed from the time that the vehicle was seized, when probable cause existed, to the time that the lockbox was searched, then why do we have a constitutional violation if his privacy interest remains at the same state?
So the way that I guess conceptually picture it in my head is the privacy interest is always constant, but the state's ability to infringe upon that with whatever is reasonable is what changes with probable cause, right? So his privacy interest, in our view, is the same, but because there was no probable cause, the state can't overcome that privacy interest. And, Your Honor, just the only other point that I want to make sure I address with my time is respect to the inevitable discovery doctrine. So, you know, in the portions of the record cited by counsel for the state, they mentioned that one of the officers testified that typically the process is, you know, people show up at the impound lot, they take stuff out of the car, throw it in their vehicle, and get out of there. I'm paraphrasing, but that's, you know, what they said. I don't think it would be proper for the court to assume, because there's nothing in the record to say this, that officers would have conducted an inventory of the items that were removed from the vehicle before they left the impound lot, because the facts don't tell us that, and to the contrary, you know, we just don't need to get it and get out. And the only other point that I would raise with respect to the fresh probable cause, Your Honor, is that, you know, both officers testified, and it's very clear from the record, that no one saw the lockbox get removed from the car. So,
but that's not disputed, and the district court found that, and you're not claiming that finding is clearly erroneous, are you?
I'm not claiming that the finding is clearly erroneous. What I'm claiming is clearly erroneous are the observations, and I think the district court was a little unclear with respect to did they observe her removing the lockbox from the car as opposed to when the lockbox was first viewed.
Well, it didn't just magically appear in her hands. I mean, she was rummaging around with nothing, and then she comes out with something.
But, Your Honor, I guess the counterpoint to that would be, again, to that Compagnavon case, where it was undisputed that the backpack in that case was in the car at one point, but the determinative factor in the court's analysis was probable cause did not arise for the vehicle it was undisputedly in until after it had been removed. That's the line in the sand, right? It's when did probable cause arise? Did it arise while officers knew that that item existed within the car? Or did it arise after that item had already been removed? And our position is that it's the latter in this case. Probable cause, you know, went away during that period. And again, you know, our position on this is that we know that this is the case because officers, you know, gave Ms. Edwards somewhat of a, you know, a loose ability to go into the vehicle unobserved. And if they had truly believed that there was evidence of criminal activity, that would not have happened. For these reasons, Your Honor, we respectfully ask that appellant's conviction is overturned based on the unlawful search.
Thank you. Anything else from the panel?
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. Counsel, thank you very much for your arguments today. They were very helpful in your submissions. We'll take the matter.